For our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service now presents the following program. That program is The Independent, the Indie Week, and this issue is February 13th of 2025, and it's read to you by John Federson. We'll mention that at the close of this broadcast, first broadcast on Friday, February the 14th, that this issue will be available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. And the Indie Week takes us to a union election now underway, or will shortly be underway, at Amazon's RDU number 1 warehouse. Voting did begin today in this election in Garner that could make the sprawling facility the second unionized Amazon workplace in the United States. Workers will vote through Saturday on whether to unionize under Carolina Amazonians United for Solidarity and Empowerment, or CAUSE cause, which needs support from more than half of those who cast ballots to win. 4,300 workers at the warehouse will be eligible to vote. If successful, the union would push for $30 hourly wages, hours-long paid lunch breaks, increased paid time off, consistent scheduling, and faster accommodations for injured workers. The vote comes amid escalating tensions and allegations that Amazon has intensified its anti-union tactics in recent weeks. As Amazon has ramped up its anti-union campaign, organizers have fought back, setting up a camp outside the warehouse and rallying support from labor leaders nationwide, including veterans of the successful Staten Island Union drive, whose visit ended in arrest on the eve of this election. Speaking to students in a Duke University union activism class last Thursday, cause organizer Italo Medelius said Amazon has been exploiting cultural divisions within the warehouse's workforce, saying Amazon knows that this election is hinging on Hispanic votes. Medelius, who is Peruvian and has worked at RDU since 2022, alleged that Amazon targets different nationalities with distinct messaging as part of its union-busting tactics. He said in a text message to the Indy, "We've seen the union busters in the Spanish-language information meetings hit on the usual tropes. The union is for lazy people. You are all are the hard workers. The union is not for Hispanics," which is easily taken as a race trope. Amazon spokesperson Aline Hards wrote in an email to Indy that Medelius' allegations are false. Medelius also described a visible escalation in anti-union messaging throughout the warehouse in recent weeks. There are TV screens throughout RDU playing anti-union videos on a loop, he said, and managers have been holding daily town halls that Medelius characterizes as vote no rallies on a stage next to the ship dock, the same location where the union election is being held this week. When asked about these town halls, Hards said they are, quote, held by many companies and have been legal for over 70 years, unquote. To combat Amazon's messaging and spread their own information, cause organizers have set up a, quote, camp on the sidewalk outside the warehouse with tents and tables where they barbecue hot dogs and hamburgers and distribute union materials to workers during shift changes. Leading up to the vote, more than 120 people gathered Saturday across the street from RDU 1 for a rally that became a thunderous display of labor solidarity. Representatives from more than a dozen unions, the Union of Southern Service Workers, Duke Graduate Student Union, Durham Association of Educators, UE150, local branches of United Auto Workers and International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, among others, delivered speeches translated into Spanish by two interpreters. They were joined by leaders from the Teamsters and a delegation from Amazon's JFK8 warehouse in Staten Island. The rally's energy built throughout the afternoon. The Durham Labor Choir performed three songs, including a union-themed rendition of Chappell Roan's Hot to Go, called Got to Go. Billionaires have got to go. Workers' rights are on a roll. Prime delivery trucks honked in support as they left the warehouse, drawing cheers from ralliers. Adding to the spectacle was Orrin Starn, a Duke professor who was fired from RDU1 earlier this year after working 6 months at the warehouse while researching a book about Amazon. Starn appeared in costume as Jeff Bezos, complete with a bald cap, blue Origin-style jumpsuit, and a toy spaceship tucked in his belt, marching around and declaring, "I do not believe in equality. I believe in hierarchy and injustice." Amazon Labor Union founder Chris Smalls, who, like Cause President Ryan Brown, was fired by Amazon in 2020 amid organizing efforts at their respective warehouses, headlined the event. Smalls led Staten Island's JFK warehouse to the first and only successful Amazon union victory in 2021. "This is a lifetime fight that you signed up for," he told the crowd. "You cannot have one foot in and one foot out. You gotta have both feet in this fight." While JFK8's victory marked a watershed moment for Amazon organizing, the ALU has faced significant challenges since then. Internal leadership disputes emerged amid allegations of financial mismanagement and a lack of transparency, and the union has still yet to negotiate a first contract with Amazon, which has maintained that the election was invalid. The union recently sought broader support by affiliating with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters in 2024. If successful, at RDU1, Cause plans to operate independently. On Sunday night, the eve of the election, Garner police arrested a JFK8 worker who was stationed at the Cause camp outside RDU1. Organizers said the arrest occurred around 9 p.m. as the ALU contingent was preparing to return to New York, and that the worker who serves as ALU's recording secretary was released several hours later. Sultana Hossein had been formally trespassed from the property earlier that day at Amazon's request, according to Garner Police Captain Michael Midland, who said police first responded to a call from Amazon Loss Prevention about Hossein at 10:49 a.m. When Hossein returned to the property that evening, she was arrested for second-degree trespassing. That incident comes 2 months after Garner police arrested three Cause supporters who were distributing food and union information outside the warehouse. Continuing now to Raleigh and the city government, Raleigh City Council has changed how it receives public comments. At its meeting Tuesday, the Raleigh City Council voted unanimously to adopt the city attorney's recommendation of adding clarifications about the purpose of public comment to the city website, as well as in a statement the mayor will read prior to the public comment sessions. That council voted 7-1 to revise its digital media process to prohibit broadcasting digital media during public comment sessions, and to allow for speakers to submit PDF and JPEG files as visual aids that will be included with the agenda. At its meeting just last Tuesday, the City Council will meet, will consider changes to how it receives public comments. In a memo to the Council, City Attorney Karen McDonald outlined ways the council could clarify the purpose of public comments to speakers, revise its process for displaying digital media during comments, and revise one of its regularly held public sessions to start earlier or last for a shorter period of time. The council currently offers two public comment sessions. One, which the council is considering curtailing in some way, is held at 7 p.m., on the second Tuesday of each month, lasts for 3 hours, and is capped at 165 speakers, with a one-minute speaking time, or up to 3 minutes if there are fewer speakers signed up. The public has an additional hour following the City Council's third Tuesday afternoon session to speak. That session is capped at 50 speakers, with a one-minute speaking time or longer, again, if fewer speakers are signed up. Members of the public are allowed to display visual media like slides and images and video, which many speakers utilized in the past year to try to urge the council to pass a Gaza ceasefire resolution. Anti-abortion groups and others have also used video to get their messages across during council public comment sessions in the past. And Raleigh has rules of decorum governing public comments that include mandating advance sign-up to speak, barring speakers from relinquishing extra time to others, prohibiting personal attacks, threats, insults, and profanity, and prohibiting the audience from disrupting. At the council's annual retreat held at the end of last month, council members discussed ways to improve public comment sessions, even after it had made some changes to those protocols last year. Mayor Janet Cowell said improving communication between the city and public was one of the most common issues she heard about on the campaign trail, saying, "I felt a lot of anger from the citizens. They felt like they'd been shut out of City Hall. They were no longer going to sit through hours of public comment, that some of the material being shown was so graphic they didn't want to bring their children into the chamber. I got a lot of feedback on this, a sense that a lot of people wanted us to relook at this." Raleigh is fairly unique among North Carolina municipalities in that it allows speakers to use digital media during their comments, according to city officials. In addition to Raleigh, only two of the 12 largest municipalities allow speakers to do so. Those would be Durham and Greensboro. And there are challenges associated with digital media. Technical difficulties can be frustrating to city staff and speakers, and there are security risks of introducing harmful material into the city's system through digital content. Finally, there are legal issues. Content that is inappropriate for minors, for example, or incompatible with requirements from other platforms the city uses to stream meetings such as YouTube. At the retreat, Deputy City Attorney Dorothy Kibler told the council there is no requirement under state law that digital media be used during these sessions, but if it is used, the council is extremely limited in what it can restrict. Kibler said First Amendment protections are triggered. Council member Jonathan Lambert Melton said there's a speculation, quote, real or not, that the city council is being distracted by the amount of time we're spending on public comment and on issues that some folks perceive not to be city-related issues. He added he's heard from residents who say they aren't willing to sign up for public comment because, while they may have, quote, a legitimate issue they need us to hear about, they don't want to sit through 3 hours of a meeting. They don't want to sit through a graphic that maybe personally disagree with or may find offensive. Lambert Melton said he wanted to see if the city could find ways to get council members any visual media relevant to residents' concerns without displaying it publicly. In her memo, the city attorney recommends instructing speakers to submit materials to council members ahead of their speaking times in some way to be determined. Melton said, "I feel like public comment is intended for folks to come to us and say, here's a concern I'm having, can you please help me? And how do we provide space for that?" Finally, council members at this retreat said they feel the purpose of the comment periods needs some clarifying, specifically that council members are there to listen to the public, not to respond to them on the spot. Mayor Pro Tem Stormy Forte said, "People are coming to speak, and they're asking us questions and expecting us to answer, and I don't think folks understand what our rules of decorum are. They can come and say whatever they want. They can ask whatever question. But it's really in the purview of the mayor as to whether she offers a response or asks the city manager to follow up. McDonald's memo advises either providing additional guidance on public comment on the city website or having the mayor read a statement before these public comment periods, clarifying the purpose and the council's role. The memo also advises revising this second Tuesday evening public session to last 1 hour, with up to 50 speakers allowed to comment, implementing an earlier fixed start time, either 5:30 or 6 p.m., or holding the public comment meeting directly after its regularly scheduled 4 p.m. work session on that day. These options, states the memo, would provide predictability to speakers so they could make work or care arrangements and make meetings more efficient, quote, and thus allow council more opportunities to interact informally with residents outside the council meeting setting. The memo also says that Raleigh currently exceeds public comment requirements under North Carolina law, and if it adopts all the revisions described in the memo, it will still exceed those legal requirements. All right, and as I look through our Indie Week for this week, there are not that many specific Black History Month related articles, but this one certainly is, and it's called Five Ways to Recognize Black History Month in the Triangle. Nearly five decades ago, in February 1976, President Gerald R. Ford issued a federal recognition of Black History Month. The Republican president wrote in a letter from the White House, in the country's bicentennial year, the recognition was, quote, an opportunity to honor the too often neglected accomplishments of Black Americans in every area of endeavor throughout our history. In February of 2025, we are living in a profoundly different moment, one in which honoring Black history and acknowledging the past and ongoing adversity the Black community faces is increasingly seen as subversive. Recognizing Black History Month on a community level feels more important than ever. Below are a few suggestions for how to spend the month. This list is by no means exhaustive, but hopefully it can serve as a starting point. And first, take a walking tour of Raleigh's civil rights history. This month, the state capitol is offering its free walking tour titled We've Always Been Here, every Friday in February from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. The half-mile route begins at Charles Keck's Three President statue of James Polk, Andrew Jackson, and Andrew Johnson, located outside the Capitol, and will wind through downtown as the tour touches on 20th century social movements in Raleigh. Now you could go to see a film screening. North Carolina Museum of Art, NCMA, typically holds a few film screenings every month. Up first this month, February 8th, well, that's already gone by, Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat. That's Colonial Narratives, Music History, and How Black Jazz Luminaries Came to Be Used as CIA Pawns in the 1961 Assassination of Congo Leader Patrice Lumumba. I haven't seen that one. On February the 22nd, the museum will show Family Tree, a documentary exploring the fight of Black families in rural North Carolina to preserve their land. Family Tree screened at last year's Full Frame Documentary Film Festival, and you can read our interview with its director, Jennifer MacArthur, at Indie Week in the archives. Film screenings for NC Museum of Art members are $5 and $10 for non-members. And if you go to the NC Museum of Art website, it will show you the times or the time of day on February 22nd. Over in Durham, North Carolina Central University is holding a free screening on November 7th. That can't be right. Anyway, that can't be right. Wilmington on Fire, a 2015 documentary about a shocking chapter in North Carolina history when a militia of white supremacists overthrew Wilmington's thriving multiracial government in 1898 and massacred more than 60 black residents. Now, North Carolina Central Museum also has a permanent collection. That museum at NCCU boasts an astonishing permanent collection with 1,300 pieces by Seminole black artists, including Romare Bearden, Jacob Lewis, Sam Gilliam, and Kerry James Marshall. Beginning February 9th, running through March the 16th, the museum will highlight works from its permanent collection by the sculptor and graphic artist Elizabeth Catlett. She was born in 1915, just two generations from the end of slavery. Both her maternal and paternal grandparents were born into slavery and went on to study art at Howard University. Her work, notably her commanding raised wooden fist sculptures and striking social realist linocuts, are instantly recognizable. Catlett was a passionate activist throughout her life, eventually decamping to Mexico, where she continued to be involved in the civil rights movement. Here's a lesser-known item in her biography. In the mid-1930s, Catlett lived in her mother's hometown of Durham. Here she taught public school for 2 years and participated alongside Thurgood Marshall in a fight, unsuccessful at the time, for equal pay for her fellow black schoolteachers. Although her Durham stint was brief, the summers she spent visiting her maternal grandparents strongly influenced the imagery in her work. Sharecroppers and other scenes of rural black southern life and struggle. Black History Month events often involve heavy topics that need processing. For another museum event on February 9th, consider attending the Nasher Museum of Art. Well, that's over. Free Family Day. Attend a Valentine's Day concert, it says here, on February 14th. That would be, well, I'm recording this on the 13th. Music is in the air across the triangle with a series of Valentine's concert in Durham. The Durham Symphony Orchestra is putting on Voices of the Unarmed, Justice, Love, Resilience. That's a program that pays tribute to black lives lost to police violence and honors the struggle for justice. And the Indy Week, by the way, read that feature about that program in a past issue. I read that on the air. Also in Durham, you can spend an evening soaking in some smooth jazz with Luther Vandross Tribute Concert at the High Tea Heritage Center. Tickets are $43, and there's a 6 p.m. show as well as a 9 p.m. show. This is on the 14th. In Cary, neo-soul jazz performer and local legend Al Strong and bassist Chip Sharon will perform a special Valentine's Day program at the Cary Arts Center. Tickets for that show, $27. Now, in Carrboro, the headline for this section, Celebrate Black Stories in Material Culture. In Carrboro, the Arts Center there currently plays host to a beautiful exhibit, Portraits of Resistance and Resilience, which showcases portrait quilts honoring black women with roots in Wake County history. The quilts were made over the course of 9 months by members of West Raleigh Presbyterian Church and Wilson Temple United Methodist Church. A February 14th opening reception will feature wine, snacks, and covers of music by Libba Cotton. Meanwhile, over in Durham, the African American Quilters Circle celebrates 25 years in residency at the Hayti Heritage Center and marking the occasion with Ubuntu, I Am Because We Are. That is an exhibition that will run all the way through March the 16th. Following is an article that was written about an event in Raleigh, and it was posted on February the 7th, a week ago. However, I didn't read it at that point. And this involves the Wake County Justice Center, where a plainclothes ICE agent told attorneys to take their immigration conversation elsewhere. A man who identified himself as a Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement ICE agent confronted two attorneys in the hallway of the third floor of the Wake County Justice Center on Monday as they discussed an immigration-related case. The incident set off alarm bells for many in the legal advocacy community who are concerned about enhanced immigration actions that the Trump administration has promised. While it's not uncommon for ICE agents to operate in courthouses, in coordination with the county sheriff's office, agents roaming around in plain clothes is not typical, and ICE doesn't usually conduct detainment or deportation efforts in county courts. Dane Pedicord, a criminal defense attorney, says he was talking to another lawyer in the hallway when an unknown, bald, white man wearing a light blue sweater, quote, sprints up to us, rushes up on us, and points at us, and basically orders us to take our conversation elsewhere. The man, who was not wearing a uniform, then flashed an ICE badge at the two attorneys, says Pedicord, who adds that he and the other lawyers were discussing a plea for a client that, quote, had immigration consequences. The agent is being highly aggressive at this point, says Pedicord. For him to do that, we were both absolutely gobsmacked. The three then stepped into Court Judge Ashley Parker's courtroom, where they recounted what happened before the judge, or, in Pedicord's words, to, quote, have it on the record. In the clerk of court's recording of that conversation, the other lawyer can be explaining that they were talking in the hallway and what happened. The other lawyer, whom we are not naming because the sensitive nature of the situation, sounds upset. Pedicord can then be heard telling the judge he flashed his badge in a show of authority. Parker asks the agent what his name is. His response is inaudible on the recording, but he says that he is with ICE and acknowledges he did confront the attorneys, saying all I asked them to do was if they could just not have that conversation right there. Pedicord interjects, that is incorrect, Your Honor. The agent reiterates that he asked the pair to, quote, have the conversation elsewhere. Parker establishes that neither attorney knew who the agent was. The two were having a conversation in a public place, and notes that she doesn't have authority over what happens outside her courtroom. The agent then speaks for several seconds, but the recording is largely inaudible. Parker says people are allowed to say what they want and where they want outside of a courtroom. I just want to be clear, says Parker, people have First Amendment rights. We all agree with that. Parker says if the agent has an issue with the attorney's conversation, he can, quote, take that up to the state bar and say this person was being unprofessional. She also tells the agent, you literally just put yourself out there because nobody knew who you were. Whenever you flash a badge or whatever else talking to them, I understand you may have come with good intentions. However, at that point, it has obviously escalated to the point that the other attorney is extremely upset. There's more back and forth until Parker ends the conversation. I'm sorry that this happened, y'all. I mean, honestly, I just hope we can all move forward. You're trying to do your job. Y'all are trying to do your job. We're all just trying to do our job the best that we can, and so that's just where I am with it. The judge moves on to other matters. Parker, through a spokesperson, declined to comment for this story. Pedicord says he and his colleague were leaving the courtroom. The agent still kept trying to talk to them. Pedicord says the deputies followed us out and established a presence between us and him because he was still being pretty aggressive. A spokesperson from the sheriff's office said they are aware of the incident that took place, but that no one from their agency was involved. The statement reads, the presence of ICE agents at the Wake County Justice Center is not new, and our agencies have had and will continue to have a great working relationship. An emailed message to ICE was returned with a note saying the message to ICE had been blocked. The media phone number for the ICE agency did not appear to be working. Petticord says he and the other attorney, who were still shaken, then went up to the seventh floor of the courthouse to report the incident to Wake County's Chief Superior Court Judge, Paul Ridgway. Ridgway declined to comment for this story. District Attorney Lauren Freeman of Wake County says it's unusual to have plainclothes ICE agents at the Justice Center, and historically, ICE has not conducted detainment or deportation efforts within the courthouse as a general rule. Such actions are usually coordinated through the sheriff's department, she adds, saying, we, as the judicial leadership for the district, have urged ICE that it's counterproductive for them to increase enforcement activities within the courthouse. We have a wide community of victims, witnesses, and defendants who will stop coming to court if they are at risk of being taken into custody. Freeman adds that her office has not received new guidance from either ICE or the Sheriff's Department regarding the presence of ICE agents in county courts. And she says it would be our sincere hope they don't begin to increase enforcement here. And she says she's not aware of any ICE agents at the courthouse since that incident on Monday. She says her office has reached out to local ICE authorities, quote, to make sure we continue to have that open communication and a dialogue. All right, a couple of then articles over from Durham. And we've been reading about the Durham budget shortfall in the public schools. And this article says, facing the shortfall, Durham Public Schools eye a philanthropist's donation as a potential fix. Durham Public Schools Chief Financial Officer Jeremy Titor told the board of the school board at Thursday's school board meeting he was eyeing use some of philanthropist Mackenzie Scott's $18 million donation to help fill the current $7 million budget shortfall. About $4 million from this donation made in 2022 is estimated to be unspent, with $1.5 million not yet budgeted, per Titor's presentation. The rest was set aside for various categories, including equity, professional development, and the, quote, growing together school reassignment plan. $1 million was labeled for school leadership, which Titor says, quote, seems like a placeholder. And he said, we're really stressing the word potential here because we're still having some conversation with folks on staff. He added, the estimate of available funds may change as staff take stock of potential projects which are set for this month or March. We want to make sure we honor some things that have good intentions. And now DPS announced this $7 million shortfall back in January. There is no one single reason for the gap between expected and actual expenditures this year, as the district spent more than expected on payroll, charter schools, child nutrition, and more. Even with the realignment of the Scott funds and another $1.5 million from a pre-K fund, the district would still need to come up with about $1.6 million to fix the overage. Scott's unsolicited donation to DPS is only a small portion of the $19.2 billion that the billionaire and ex-wife of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos has given away in a philanthropic blitz since 2019. Much of the money has gone to programs focused on education and equity, including HBCUs and K-12 districts. A few months, after Scott's donation, the Durham School Board approved a spending plan to allocate $8.2 million for academics, $3.5 million for charter schools, $2.5 million for HR, $1.5 million for transportation, $1.2 million for school support, and $1 million for operations. Community members initially had big dreams for the donation, In 2023, Riverside High School student publication, The Pirate's Hook, published an op-ed suggesting the money be put toward bus improvements, support for impoverished families, field trips, and classroom improvements. And on Thursday, board member Natalie Bayer said $1 million, quote, might have been for affordable teacher housing. It's a dream that this board has had for many, 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 many years. I think it's critical we not let those dreams die and those plans die. Teeter, who started as chief financial officer in November of 24, found the overage through an examination of the district finances. The last CFO, Paul Lesueur, resigned after last year's classified play debacle, in which the district tried to roll back promised raises for classified staff after realizing it didn't have the money. While they try to clean up this year's financial mess and ongoing issues providing school bus service, staff and the board seemed well aware that the budget season for next year is already underway. The public will have an opportunity to provide ideas at a February 20th hearing, and the superintendent's staff is set to put together a recommended budget by the end of March. So board member Emily Chavez told Teeter, I continue to see this as a cleanup year. Thank you for being thorough, but I'm most interested in the systems you're putting into place to ensure that our budget going forward will be accurate, tight, and centering on our students. A wonderful little article, next, also from Durham. Fresh Start Durham serves the homeless with showers on wheels. At the first light of dawn, a truck pulls into the gravel parking lot behind Trinity United Methodist Church, and volunteers in puffy jackets rush to unload supplies, their breath rising in plumes of vapor in the crisp morning air. The truck hauls a mobile unit offering something many homeless peoples otherwise lack, free access to a shower. Ibrahim Tabet, a middle-aged man with salt-and-pepper beard and a gray cap who has long used the shower service, walks up to Mary Wilson, founder of Fresh Start Durham, and gives her a hug. He says with a chuckle, I'm so happy to see my second family, but I'm really ready to shave. And he launches into a account of recent events in his life. Fresh Start Durham, founded in 2018, offers shower services to the homeless on Tuesday mornings, from 7:30 to 11 a.m. behind Trinity Methodist, that's right near Durham City Hall, and Wednesday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. at St. Joseph's Episcopal Church on West Main. Its mobile shower trailer, equipped with 5 shower stalls and 600-gallon holding tank, can provide up to 32 showers per day. Now, the nonprofit partners with local organizations like Trinity Methodist for access to water and electricity. The idea behind it is simple. Provide basic services that many take for granted, but which are often out of reach for those without stable housing. The nonprofit provides free showers in a private stall along with clean socks, undergarments, shirts, and clean towels. Mary Wilson, that group's founder, is 54. She cleans the shower stalls between clients by scrubbing the floor with disinfectant. For Wilson, providing the showers is a basic form of love and respect. Quote, if you live on the street and you're dirty and you don't have a haircut or a shave, you are marginalized in society. The very state of being clean is expected if you want to integrate into society at all. For most of Fresh Start's clients, this will be their one chance to shower this week. Homeless shelters only provide showers to residents, and the wait lists for those are weeks, if not months, long. Durham had about 415 people experiencing homelessness January of this year, up 10% from the previous year. Numbers exactly from this January's count have not yet been released. Most Tuesdays, the fresh startup sign-up sheet for showers fills up before 8:30 a.m., and volunteers must turn people away. As a crowd of 50 people gathers, some carrying backpacks, others walking dogs or pushing strollers, volunteers greet each person. Inside a shower cubicle, the smell of soap and lotion and the sound of water splashing against plastic fill that small space. Perched on the door handles of the stalls are the name tags of the people occupying them. Steam rises faintly from the shower units, while just across from them, the barber, hired by Fresh Start, has laid out combs, scissors, and clippers on a table in preparation for the morning. The peaceful rhythm of the morning is shattered by a sharp cry near the sign-up tent. Two men are locked in a scuffle by the folding chairs. One, a wiry man in a tattered coat, stumbles to the ground, clutching his side. "I think a guy just got cut with a box cutter," shouts Joe Wilson, Mary's husband. Mary Wilson springs into action, running toward the injured man as she shouts for her husband to toss her a first aid kit. The two quickly help the injured man into a folding chair to examine the wound, while another man crouches nearby, urging calm. The injured man's partner, visibly shaken, tells Wilson what happened. The box cutter used in the attack was the man's own, stolen from him moments earlier and used against him in the altercation. To everyone's relief, the cut is shallow, barely breaking the skin. Still, a member of Hart Durham's nonviolent response team, who sometimes stops by on Tuesday, calls EMS as a precaution, and the man's loaded into an ambulance. Wilson says he was in the fetal position, so I'm like, we're going to see some intestines right now. But it was nothing. These things happen. We learn to deal with them in the moment. Wilson's dedication to supporting vulnerable people began well before she founded Fresh Start Durham. She worked as a nurse for nearly 2 decades, starting in 1993, including 8 years at the Samaritan Health Center, a free clinic serving Durham's uninsured. During this time working in critical care, Wilson often cared for homeless individuals. She quickly came to recognize two pressing needs for people experiencing homelessness: access to showers and laundry. After paying off student loans, Wilson turned her focus to addressing these unmet needs. She and her husband bought a building in downtown Durham in 2017, hoping to create a community day center with a space for showers, laundry, and kitchen facilities, along with literacy programs and an emergency night shelter. However, the project ran into unforeseen obstacles when city regulations classified the building as a laundry facility. That triggered requirements for expensive upgrades. Wilson's husband, Joe, knew of a San Francisco program, Lava May, which provided mobile shower services to the homeless before it ceased operations. Inspired by that example, the couple bought a mobile unit in 2020, intending to use it to provide free showers. Then the pandemic struck. Well, they were finally able to get out into the community in October of 2021. And since then, they've only missed 1 week. And they provide showers in all seasons, including the winter holidays. The work doesn't stop with just a shower or a haircut, though. The volunteers also offer a space for people to be seen, heard, and supported. Mary Wilson says there are people in here that nobody will give eye contact to because they're scared. So I think that human connection is just uber important for everybody. Dahlia Robinson, 20, a Duke University junior who volunteers with Fresh Start, agrees and says it's just important to hold space, take the time to listen to what they're going through. They're all coming from somewhere. They all have some reason why they're out there. As she speaks, 5 members from Open Table Ministry, another local nonprofit serving homeless, weave through the crowd, assigning people numbers they can use to access Open Table's weekly free clothing store. Volunteers also hand out water, coffee, and homemade soup. Sean Hardy, Associate Director of Open Table, says Fresh Start's popularity has spread largely through word of mouth. Quote, I learned this early on, but the community has such a grapevine that is incredibly strong. Fresh Start Durham relies on donations and volunteer support to continue its work. I'm just going to read that again. Fresh Start Durham relies on donations and volunteer support to continue its work. Keith Ward has been using Fresh Start service for 2 years. Wearing a dark green knit sweater, Ward sips his hot chocolate, courtesy of Open Table, and waits his turn for a shower. He says, you know, if you ain't got nothing, you can come and get a start. Come and get your child and come. It's a good program. I thank the Lord for it. Wilson says the rewards of the work are many, especially when people come back and report on good developments in their lives. She says many times people will come before they go on a job interview and then come back and tell us they found employment. So we get to celebrate alongside them. She dreams of the day when her services won't be needed. I'd love this thing to go to a landfill and never need it. For now, hygiene is really important. It's very, very, very important. Back in the trailer, the soft sound of water running fills the small space. Charlie Lemon steps out of the bathroom, his face now scrubbed clean, ready to start his day. Fresh Start has made a positive impact and a real difference, he says. It's such a blessing in my life. Next, also from Durham, a lively new magazine puts Durham's young Latino artists at the center. I'm Not Weird, reads the back cover of Nuevo South's inaugural issue. Soy un Duramita. Rodrigo Dorfman, the visionary behind the magazine, says there's no static definition of Duramita. Instead, it's an invitation to second-generation Latino immigrants living in Durham to carve their own identity. Rodrigo says, you ask someone, where are you from? And they say, well, I was born in Durham, but I'm from Mexico, really. My parents are from Mexico or from Guatemala, El Salvador. They don't say, I'm a Durhamite. But if you say, what if you are a Duramita? What does that mean? Says Dorfman. He doesn't expect people to use the label that much, but loves that it pushes people to examine their own identity. Sure, the Duramitas edition of Nuevo South is not weird, but the new quarterly publication is lots of other things, independent, grounded, and ambitious. It's also impressive to experience with over 100 full-color pages of local Latino artists, photojournalism, speculative fiction, and more, bound together into one tangible, bilingual, multi-generational collaboration. Dorfman, a Durham documentarian and head of local culture and media organization Center for the Nuevo South, sees projects like this magazine as a way to address the cultural needs of the Southeast Latino community. Most recently, Dorfman and the Center for Nuevo South collaborated with PBS and Firelight Media to create Bulls and Saints, a film about an undocumented family returning home to Mexico after 20 years in the United States. Dorfman explains, Latinos have been here for centuries, passing through the night in many ways, mostly, as you know, migrant workers, academics, or doctors, or nannies of academics. He references immigration to the Southeast. Mostly it was just people never settling down. At first, all the needs were so urgent. You needed security. You needed translators. You needed a way to get a bank account. You needed to get your kids in schools. These needs were urgent, and they took over all the services given to our community because we were in a constant emergency situation. So culture was never institutionalized. It's easy to see the connection between Dorfman, who speaks about his work and community with an energy that spills out in paragraph-long sentences, and the magazine, an artistic product of content that is so varied and yet tells a continuous story from front cover to back. The story told in parts is that of the young Latinos who call Durham home. In its early pages, the magazine describes the great Latino migration, a phrase coined by Chapel Hill journalist Paul Cuadros, to describe the waves of Latinos who arrived in the South following President Ronald Reagan's 1986 Reform and Control Act, which gave 2.7 million undocumented migrants a path to citizenship. Around the same time, industries like agriculture, construction, and manufacturing began recruiting cheap labor from south of the U.S. border. Decades after the great Latino migration, it's up to the next generation to build their own sense of self, whether that's as a Duramita or not. One science fiction comic in the magazine, created by daughter-father duo Alegría Rojas Patino and Miguel Rojas Sotelo, shows pieces of the city, Duke Chapel, the Lucky Strike Water Tower, taking off into space like rocket ships. Another piece shows the results of a community portrait studio set up in various locations around Durham. Dorian Gomez, a filmmaker and storyteller whose feature on the Latino-owned businesses of Roxborough Street, appears in the issue and says that her generation is characterized by a DIY, do-it-yourself spirit. And she says of her work, the lack of spaces, the lack of particular resources pushes you to get creative. It's about using minimal resources to create something big, using something as simple as your phone or using an old camera that was used for family photos, and without having to think too much about all the fancy stencils or mirrorless cameras. It's exposure to the most raw version of a medium, and it becomes something much bigger than what was intended or imagined. For both Gomez and Dorfman, the analog nature of the magazine is part of what made the concept so appealing from the beginning. In an era when print publications are thinning out, Spanish language publications are rarer still. Those that do exist often serve larger metros like New York or Los Angeles, and few prioritize visual culture the way Nuevo South does. Dorfman says we are completely bound to the digital age because that is how we communicate with the folks back home. But he also describes a connection to the built, because so much of the labor done by Latino migrants over the decades has been so physical. They came to build factories. They came to build houses. They came to work in the chicken plants and pork industry and carpet industry. There's this feeling that what we value is that which we can touch with our hands. Gomez adds there's value, too, in leaving something physical for future generations. And she says, my grandmother used to make some of my clothes. Similarly, creating a magazine involves being able to craft something that's also connected to history, that is your history and other people's histories, a record of the fact that we exist, and we will exist. Nuevo South, which is fiscally backed by the Southern Documentary Fund, launched with a grant from Durham's Office on Youth. But going forward, Dorfman and his collaborators hope the magazine will attract enough buyers and subscribers to continue with this quarterly edition. For those interested in buying a copy, you can find one at the Scrap Exchange, the Regulator, or Tienda Don Becerra. You can also subscribe for future editions at this website, docupainting.com/ Nuevo-South-Magazine. By excellent coincidence, the boxes containing the first run of the magazine arrive at Dorfman's door as our video chat interview concludes. On screen, Gomez and I watch as he pulls out the first copy. Although he knows what's exactly in the magazine, he looks just as impressed as someone seeing it for the very first time. Oh, my God. There are 40 boxes. Gomez, get your ass down here, he says to us. It looks freaking amazing. Well, folks, it's approaching a two-minute mark of time remaining, and I let my awesome professionalism and broadcast experience of decades fall by the wayside last issue when I ran out of time reading with 2 seconds left and had to say bye. So I'm just prefacing this by this little article about the bike train will be cut short in time for me to give the closing announcement. And for those of you who felt maybe the earth had disappeared beneath your feet last week, well, so did I. So here we go. At 7:30 on a recent Wednesday morning on West Club Boulevard, Durham's youngest cycling squad started their commute to E.K. Powell Elementary School. With jackets zipped up against the cold air, bike lights flashing and neon visibility vests catching the sun's early rays, the peloton of about 10 kids, flanked by parents, had clearly left their training wheels far behind as they zoomed down the side streets of Old West Durham. The route, under 1 mile in length, took the cyclists about the same amount of time it would have taken in a car. And with the right preparation, it was perfectly safe for kids of every age. The EK bike train is not new. Parents and students have been gathering at this spot for about a year and a half. But the group has taken on new significance as Durham Public Schools continues to lack sufficient bus transit for students and parents seeking new ways to get their children safely to school. Last month, the district implemented family responsibility zones, areas in which students do not receive district transport, for 21 elementary schools, including Powell. Well, there comes my music, and it gives me time to say that I'm John Fetterson, at least I got that part right, and that I will return next week with Indie Week, the next issue. And you can find, as I already mentioned, this issue and lots, lots more by simply going to the IndieWeek.com website and just reading away. They have loads of articles, including some older ones as well. And some of those I've saved here, and hopefully I'll be able to get to them in due time. So for the ncreadingservice.org, John Fetterson says, farewell. Thank you very much for listening to Indie Week.